So, Mahayogi Maharaj, Dandavats, we are continuing our series of broadcasts. And can you tell where was the Guardian of Devotion Press situated? Was it in the San Jose Temple?
Well, we began our publications in San Jose. And so the temple at 62 South 13th Street, that was our headquarters.
And so what was the temple built around, the publishing house, or what was the
temple
team?
We had in San Jose was a wooden mansion on a quarter acre of land that was constructed by Bernard Maybeck. He's a very famous architect who built the Palacio de Bellas Artes in San Francisco, California. You can see it on the Google. It's really a beautiful building. And finally, our printing press was physically housed in the garage behind the temple. And we constructed some living quarters for the devotees also behind the temple. But in the beginning, what we did was mainly pre-press production. We did the editing, typesetting. In those days, we didn't have desktop publishing. So we did typesetting, stripping. We had to photograph the layouts and then create negatives, and from the negatives a plate for the printing press, put that on the printing press and physically print the books. We printed, I think we began physically printing our own books with Sri Guru and His Grace, but Goswami Maharaj, he'll know. The search for Sri Krishna was, we farmed that out. He went to a publishing house called R.R. Donnelly and Sons, which was responsible for the 1 million copy run of the Bhagavad Gita for Srila Prabhupada. So he went to them dressed in his dhoti and his tilak, Goswami Maharaj, and he said, "We're interested in publishing another book." And we, maybe at that time, really didn't have the money to physically publish it, but we did our best to sort of bluff our way in, because R.R. Donnelly, they don't turn on the presses for less than 50,000 copies of your book. But we explained what we wanted done, and they said, "Yeah, great, let's set it up." And the president of that company made a couple of phone calls and got us a smaller press in the Bay Area, and we printed 3,000 of the original book. But before we did that, we went to a mom and pop organization and published a 16-page booklet just to see if we could do it. And that was really the original search for Sri Krishna. It talked about reality of the beautiful. That was the introduction where, you know, Sridhar Maharaj is talking about rasa, you know, atato brahma jigyasa. Now is the time for searching into reality and what that is. But he points out that for the human soul, the real search is for rasa. It's not for eternity as such, but an eternal relationship with Krishna. So anyway, that was the history of...
So the search for Sri Krishna, as I understand, you started with just a whole bunch of cassettes with recordings of Sridhar Maharaj. But how did it unfold? It like now we are working on archive. How do you collect all this fat and like?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, at that time, Goswami Maharaj was preaching on the basis of the cassette. So he'd listen to a cassette in the morning, and in the afternoon preach that to the devotees, and the next day listen to another cassette. So after a while, he got a feel for what was going to be useful. And he'd say, "You know, I really like what Guru Maharaj was saying here." And then I might say, "Yeah, I heard something similar on another cassette." And in this way, we started listening to certain sections of certain cassettes, and then we could see, all right, here he's talking about Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the nectarine ocean of rasa. And here he's talking about rasa also, but in a different way. He's saying, search for the divine. So we brought those together and tried to create something.
Uh-huh. And How did came the idea of publishing the other books? I've heard that the process of first book was like going back, going to India, going back, always consulting with Sridhar Maharaj. So it probably took some like years of your life.
Yes, it did, in fact. I dedicated 10 years of my life to publishing these books. And we really put out about five major publications, so say 2 years for each title. And the first book, we were establishing Sridhar Maharaj as someone who could speak on a very high level of Krishna consciousness and at the same time defeat the opposition. He could give something simple that an ordinary person could understand and at the same time take it to the highest level. So we begin the book talking about the search for truth, and we end the book with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself questioning Ramananda Roy about the ultimate reality. And the particular answers that Ramananda Roy gives Mahaprabhu form the real essence of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, which goes up to the highest level of service.
So it's like a popular version of the Ramananda Samvada that Sridhar Maharaj was specialized in.
The thing is, the actual book itself is synthetic. It's not really a popular version of anything. What Sridhar Maharaj gives is very concentrated. You know, like if you have really concentrated orange juice, you can make, you know, liters and liters of it. If you have a highly concentrated orange juice, maybe you could make a swimming pool of it, you know? But what Hari Charan always used to say, and I forget what part of the Chaitanya Charitamrita that's from, but he always used to close every lecture that he gave. He would say, Ek Bindu Jagat Dubai. One drop of this can satisfy the universe. That means this is so concentrated that if you come in contact with it, it will purify the universe. So the search for Sri Krishna is like that. It's very highly concentrated devotional nectar, if you like. And just by a little taste of that, it will satisfy you, it will transform your life, and then you will go out and transform other people's lives, and gradually the transformation will be total.
Yes, I would like.
That's how we felt.
And talking about the opposition, there is very famous moment when Sridhar Maharaj was meeting Srila Prabhupada when he just first time came from America. Oh, the disciple of Saraswati Thakur who came from England. And he brought like 10 questions that couldn't be answered by him from the Europe. And Sridhar Maharaj, he just cracked them in like half hour.
Bon Maharaj.
Yes, Bhan Maharaj, when he returned from London, he was chagrined that he was unable to properly satisfy the opposition he met. And he expressed this to Saraswati Thakur, saying, they had questions I couldn't answer. And then Sridhar Maharaj stepped forward and said, what are those questions? I can answer that. And it's true, he could answer that, and he still does. And his followers can answer those questions. Govinda Maharaj can answer those questions. Anyone who studies this line can satisfy the questions and doubts offered by even the latest scientists and philosophers who don't believe in theism. Unfortunately, Sridhar Maharaj was not available for preaching in the West at that time, or we might have a different history. Perhaps that was his nature. Sridhar Maharaj's nature was not so much with standing before a public and promoting the line of Krishna consciousness, but he was more of a thinker. When he was called upon, he could satisfy any question. Yeah.
So was this Search for Sri Krishna publication some kind of a message, since Goswami Maharaj like brought Sridhar Maharaj to the West? Was this like the fight back?
You keep coming back to the same point, which is what's the real purpose of that book? And so it's something like this. If you try to preach Krishna consciousness, you'll meet opposition. And then you'll have some questions. And then you'll go somewhere and say, I couldn't answer these questions. How do I do it? That's what the search for Sri Krishna is meant for. That's Guru Maharaj actually answering those questions that Bon Maharaj had. The scientists say this, how do we answer Darwin? How do we answer fossilism? And he would say, well, it's very simple. But how? Do we try to promote the idea that the earth was created in 7 days or something? No, it's very simple. You have to think, does matter come from consciousness, or does consciousness produce matter? It's a very simple point. Look at the order and structure and design in the universe. Does that come from nothing? How would that be possible? It doesn't make any sense at all. So could a stone create human consciousness? According to certain scientific points of view, that's what it's all about. Guru Maharaj uses the example of a stone. And, you know, the scientists, they don't exactly say a stone, but they're talking about chemicals, chemical combinations, molecular structure. Does that produce consciousness? Well, it never has. And with the best minds and the best computers and thousands and millions of internet connections all jamming at the same time to work out a scientific way to produce consciousness, they can't do that. So what's the solution of science? The solution of science is to tell you, well, we have produced really good products in the past. Trust us. In the future, we'll work it out. But it still doesn't solve the problem. On the other hand, Guru Maharaj points out that anything that you see or feel or touch is a product of consciousness. And, you know, if you want the full argument, read the book. But is it easy to believe that a conscious mind can produce something? Yes, it is. We're sitting in a house. Who made the house? Consciousness. You know, the cameras, the lights, the computers, all of this is a product of consciousness. Even the body that I'm inside of, it's been transformed by consciousness. So how consciousness works on material energy is a subject that scientists might dedicate themselves to understanding. But how matter can produce consciousness, it's a failed paradigm. You can't get there from here. And Guru Maharaj discusses that in his chapter on fossilism. So getting back to your point, the whole idea of the book is to try to give the devotees weapons that they can use for cutting through this kind of material ignorance, if you like.
And in Search for Sri Krishna, there are like many chapters, but some of them, like Saint Scriptures Guru and the fossilism and subjective evolution, they're unfolded in the other books, like the second book, Sri Guru and His Grace. So how came the idea or necessity for the following books?
Well, these are topics that the devotees like to return to again and again. So if our first book was to introduce Sridhar Maharaj, to give an idea of his basic concepts, to promote Gaudiya Vaishnavism, to show that we do have a basis for what we're saying. It's not just speculation. Saints
Saints, scriptures, and gurus.
And gurus. Yeah, that's a chapter about the Bhagavad Gita. So the devotees are asking Sridhar Maharaj, well, what is the meaning of the Bhagavad Gita, basically? And he gives a short summary of that. Well, Bhagavad Gita is important to us because here you have Krishna himself describing the philosophy. So we keep coming back to that again and again, very naturally. But Search for Sri Krishna gives you a taste. Sri Guru and His Grace is a very different kind of production, all right? There's some topics that really are not for the general public. Some topics are really more for devotees who are experienced and want to go deeper. So if the search for Sri Krishna is more universal and something you could translate into Hungarian, and the people of Hungary would like it, Sri Guru and His Grace is a little bit more esoteric because it touches on the topic of guru, who can be a teacher. This topic was very important to us because after the disappearance of Prabhupada, many people didn't know where to turn. They felt that they were becoming involved with people who are not qualified really as guru. So we wanted to understand more about the qualification of guru. Who is really guru? What is guru tattva? This is a nice chapter in the Gaudiya Kantahara called Guru Tattva, where that's elaborated, and Guru Maharaj referred us to that again and again. So also, I think it was the French writer Stendhal who said, I write books that I need to read myself. So at that time, I explained in our last interview, I was going through a spiritual crisis with my own guru-disciple relationship. And I was burning with a passion to try to come to a conclusion, a closure, to really connect with a qualified guru. And I felt that other people would profit from my experience as well. So that's what drove me personally to do my best to create a text that would expose the importance of guru. And Goswami at the time was also fascinated by that, as many devotees were. So if the first wave of disciples who came to Guru Maharaj had questions that couldn't be answered, and they wanted some way to deal with the opposition, the second wave started thinking, well, you know, maybe here in Sridhar Maharaj we have someone who's really a realized guru, and perhaps he can help us sort out some of the problems that we have surrounding the whole guru issue. Guru bhakti is a very essential part of Vaishnavism and Krishna consciousness, so it was fitting and appropriate that that was our second title.
It's one of the wise sayings that if you want to like really understand something, everything comes through service. You need to like put it out, like write it. But it seems to me that most of the time you're working in America, but how did you felt empowered by Guru Maharaj, and how you gained the qualification to properly represent him in all these books? Was he I've heard he was really appreciating the work that was done on these publications.
Well, the system was we would go to India for a couple of months in the time when it wasn't so hot, which is probably February, March, April, Gur Purnim. By Gur Purnim, it started to warm up, and we would come home armed with cassettes. So I would watch Guru Maharaj and sit at his feet and take notes and listen very carefully. And other devotees would do as you're doing. They'd make videos and tape recordings. But I did my best to really intently listen to everything that he said. Excuse me. And every day at the end of the day, I would come downstairs, and devotees would be arriving from Calcutta or from Navadweep, or they came back on the rickshaw from the bajar, and they would say, well, what did Guru Maharaj say? What was his talk? And so I would represent that to them. And then someone would ask, some other person would ask me, what did Guru Maharaj say? And I would represent that to him. So sometimes we neglect the teachings of our Guru Maharaj, and we forget certain things. But if you serve the message, if you teach that or preach it, it becomes part of you. So in a way, by listening to Guru Maharaj and then preaching what he said on the same day, and then maybe traveling back to London or Germany, our flight would always take us through London, through Germany. Sometimes I went to Budapest, I went to Vienna, I went to Stockholm. And the devotees there would be curious, what's the new thing? What did Guru Maharaj say now? So I would be representing that. By the time we got back to San Jose, California, then I would be familiar with 15, 25 hours of new lectures by Guru Maharaj on the subject that we were trying to penetrate, in this case, Guru Tattva. And then we would start working on that book. So while it was still fresh in my mind, then we would go back to the cassettes and I could compare my notes and what I remembered with what he actually said. And then we would carefully try to look up the Sanskrit quotes, the Bengali, and assemble a chapter. And then we would think, okay, well, on a given day, maybe he spoke for 45 minutes and he touched on the importance of selecting a guru for 3 minutes. But 2 days later, he talks about the same thing, and this time for 17 minutes. That we would try to put that together in an interesting way, and that could be a chapter or a chapter title. So your question is, how was I able to represent Guru Maharaj's message? Well, we studied his message personally by questioning and listening. Then we saw how Govinda Maharaj, for example, dealt with practical matters. And also, he would correct us. He would say, yes, Guru Maharaj is saying this, but you should also understand that. So that would form part of our consciousness about the message. And later we would listen to the cassette and try to correct everything and put it down very carefully. So you can see that book is a very good representation of Guru Maharaj's teachings on the subject of guru. Who is a guru? Who's fit to be a guru? When can you leave a guru? How do you serve? All these different questions. It's a very dangerous book.
Yes, that's why we like it.
The most dangerous thing in that book is, well, there's a few very dangerous ideas. Right? One idea is it may be necessary to have different gurus in different stages of your life. And that's a very painful, dangerous thing to say, but it's true. When you're 6 years old, maybe your mother is your guru or your father, or you have a favorite person in the elementary school, a favorite teacher in your primary school, and she's everything. She teaches you everything. She teaches you how to put a plant, put a little seed in a styrofoam cup that has some earth in it and put water on it. And you have to wait for days and the seed sprouts. And that's a marvel. It's a wonderful thing. And so this teacher, she's everything to you. She takes off your shoes when it snows outside, takes off your boots, you know, and puts them in a warm place and tells you it's time to go to sleep now. But later, you have to go to a more advanced school and perhaps they teach you the history of your country, geography, science. But even that will be a simple idea. They give you a simple idea of science. They tell you that this is the velocity of a falling object. And later you go to the university and they say, well, in quantum physics, velocity is more difficult to work out. So you leave behind Newton and have to embrace Einstein, and it's a deeper conception. So throughout your whole life, you're accepting different gurus. At one point, if you tell your teacher in the school, well, my mother said this, sometimes the teacher will say, your mother was wrong. And that's a conflict. How can I accept that my mother is wrong? She's my guru. But your elementary school teacher will say, well, maybe she was, and they try to adjust things. In the same way, even in Krishna consciousness, when we're young devotees, we meet some devotee in the Harinam Kirtan party, and he tells us, chant Hare Krishna and be happy. It's cool. It's ecstatic. It's a good vibration. And you accept that person as your guru, and you think, they know everything. They know what prasadam is. They know what Radha Krishna is. They know what the Bhagavad Gita is. They know Sanskrit. They know everything. But it may be that later you find out that this person is really the man who sweeps up the kitchen in the temple, and he's not really the highly qualified devotee that you may have thought he was, and you accept some sannyasi as your spiritual guide. But then later he tells you, actually, I'm not the one. The real guru is Avadhut Maharaj or Govinda Maharaj or Sridhar Maharaj. So there's a constant evolution in your guru-disciple relationship, and that may involve seeing your absolute guru from a relative point of view at one point in your life, and that's a very disturbing thing. So there's dangerous material in the search for Sri Krishna. Another incredibly dangerous idea is the idea of the Shiksha Guru Parampara.
And also there are other free books to continue the light run through for the whole series. What was the chronology
of talk about the Shiksha Guru Parampara,
yes,
because that's what I just brought up. Shiksha Guru Parampara is fascinating because the word Shiksha, actually it's, you know, probably in Bengali they don't say the S. It's, you know, like Lakmi, Shikha, you know, they don't really pronounce it that way, but it means instruction. So there are some paramparas, you know, or disciplic lines that formulate their line on the basis of, there's the sun god Vivasvan, and after him Ikshvaku, and then Manu, and then Vyas, and our line comes directly, you know, from that. One guru initiates a disciple, and he initiates another disciple, and he initiates another disciple, and that man is my guru. So I'm the servant of the servant of the servant of the servant of Krishna himself. My line goes directly back to him. That's a particular point of view. In India, that might be more represented by the Ramanuja line or the Madhva line, because the Acharya of the Ramanuja line, he'll say, well, my guru was initiated by the student of the student of the student of Ramanuj, who was the original. So you think, well, okay, this is a pure product. What I'm getting is pure because it's received. It goes from father to son, to son to son, to father to son, like that. India is a fascinating civilization because, in a sense, it's an unbroken civilization that goes back to the beginning of time, where if you find a wood carver, you'll see that his father carved wood, and before him his father, and before him his father, and somebody's following the same school. So this is a very appealing idea to us. Unfortunately, we're not talking about carving wood. We're talking about spiritual truth. So you can look at the Catholic Church, for example, and see that, okay, one pope gave it to the next man, and he gave it to the next man, and he named the next pope, or they had a council, and the council nominated the next cardinal. There's a hierarchy. But the truth does not necessarily follow a hierarchy, and that's a very dangerous idea as well. It's something like in the history of music. There was Bach. J.S. Bach was a great composer. But who was his student? Well, maybe his children. He had, there was a Christian Bach, who was one of the children of Bach, was also a great composer. You know, Johann Sebastian Bach. I may not be pronouncing it correctly for the German disciples. But if you look at the history of music, who is really the follower of Bach? Is it one of his children? No, it's Mozart. You can look at Handel, and he produced some good stuff. But really, if you want to see who's the next great light in classical music, it's Mozart. There's no question about that. He takes the principles of harmony that were used by Bach, and he extends them and creates something new, right? If you want to see, well, who's the disciple of Mozart, you can look at his music students and people who learned from him. And maybe Mozart himself will say, Salieri here, he is the next in the line. He really understands my conception. But if you look at music, you have to say Beethoven. So it's Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven. Was Mozart an initiated disciple of Bach? Not really. Did he take the principles of Bach and move them to a higher level? Absolutely. So if you ask Beethoven, who's the greatest composer in music, what does he say? He says, well, I am. And they say, well, but what about Bach? And then he says, oh, but Bach, he is music. He's not a composer, he is music. So in the same way, real spiritual truth, it may not pass exactly from one guru to one disciple in the way that we're told. And this is a revolutionary and a dangerous idea. We should, of course, obey the disciplic succession. And if our guru tells us, follow him, he has the idea, we should trust what he says. But in the end, these things will be judged by history. History will tell us, okay, the great follower of Bach was Mozart. So in the same way, if you look at the disciplic succession from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you can say, well, okay, there's Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami and Raghunath Das. And after that, there's Kaviraj Goswami. And Narottam Das Thakur, was he initiated by Kaviraj Goswami? Well, not really. But who has the great idea? Who can really represent Gaudiya Vaishnavism after Kaviraj Goswami in Bengal? It's Narottam Das Thakur. So there are those who say, no, you must follow the children of the Goswamis. But we don't accept that. So we have the Shiksha Guru Parampara. And this is another dangerous idea that's in the book. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to speak too much at length.
No, sorry. I just it sounds like the one of the new flows that's named the meritocracy. Like like there was by the birth and judging people a lot of ways, but now they say it's meritocracy. How much do you do? Like how much you benefit like the society or the parampara, judged by this?
Well, this, like I said, it's for history to judge in a way. If you really look at the parampara and you say, okay, well, who succeeds Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur? It's still young for us to give the true judgment of history because only 50, I don't know, how many years have passed since his disappearance? You would know.
41st?
When did he disappear? In the 1930s, 30. I think.
41.
Okay, so that's more than 50 years now. I think 50 because I was born in 1953. But 50, yeah. So something like 70 years have passed. And you can look at the line of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and say, well, who really succeeded him? Was it the man that he named in his will? Was it somebody who, even though he didn't name him in the will, he told everybody, this man understands me. Because you can say, oh, the person who's named in the will, he's the important one. Follow him. Or you can say, oh, no, that's a legal document. Remember, legal documents have legal purposes. He's doing that for the management. The person who really understood him was, you know, so-and-so. But look at Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and who really succeeds him? I think, because I'm his disciple, of course, so I would say Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. He is the standout follower of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, because I would not be sitting here today if it weren't for Prabhupada coming to New York and chanting Hare Krishna in Tompkins Square Park in 1965. I wouldn't be here. He brought it to the West. He had that genius. He had the power. As a consequence of what he did, the waves of that ocean that he gave are still crashing on distant shores, like in China. Right now, China is just beginning to become interested in Krishna consciousness. That's 1 billion human beings You know, if 1 billion human beings decide, yes, you're right, Ek bin du, jigad Dubai, one drop of this can satisfy the universe, then that changes everything. But who initiated that was really Swami Prabhupada. Okay? So if you look at Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, you have to say, all right, it's going in that direction. But you cannot discount Sridhar Maharaj either. Because if you go to Prabhupada and you say, this is really great what you're teaching. Where did you get this? Are you a big follower of Saraswati Thakur? In his humbleness, Prabhupada will say, well, you know, it wasn't possible for me to attend every lecture given by Saraswati Thakur. I met him a couple of times and he told me, if you ever get money, print books. But I lived in Calcutta and I had a pharmacy in Calcutta, and upstairs from the pharmacy, there was this other disciple of Saraswati Thakur who had his ashram there, and that was Bhakti Rakshak Sridhar Dev Goswami. And if you really want to know, actually, I learned a lot from him. So he is my Shiksha Guru. So you can see there's a very powerful electric current coming from these two great gurus. And who will be the greatest disciples of Prabhupada and Sridhar Maharaj? Well, we have Govinda Maharaj. And the person best qualified to speak about Govinda Maharaj is probably Bhakti Lalita, who's sitting here. So I won't try, and we're short on time. I'll just take some more questions.
Yeah, so Sri Guru and His Grace, in the end, it's the book for disciples. And when it's come to disciples, it's always like your choice, and like it's up to you, you choose your guru for you that you will devote. And connected with this, we have a question from Kamala. Maybe let me read it. Dandavas Maharaj, you mentioned selecting a guru. It seems self-evident that the aspiring new devotee has no real understanding of guru tattva. Yet they need such understanding in order to discriminate between authentic and bogus gurus. So if they make a mistake in their choice, is that part of Krishna's plan for them, or is it just due to their insincerity?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say hello to Kamala and Hare Krishna and Dandavats. After all these years, it's good to hear from you. Anybody who's listening to this, by the way, or watching, please send your comments and questions along, because we want to hear from you. This is a very fascinating question. How do you know a real guru when you see one? Well, you may have to make a few mistakes along the way. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his book, The Life and Precepts of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he talks about ruchi. He says there's some kind of innate flavor that you can get from Krishna consciousness, from being associated with a genuine Vaishnava line. And once you have a little bit of that flavor, you know what that is, and you know how to recognize it. And sometimes it's stronger, and sometimes you can find it more concentrated, and sometimes it's very weak. So just like we know what pure water is, everyone knows what pure water is. If somebody gives you a glass of water and they say, this water is pure water, and you drink it and you taste something that's not really supposed to be there, it's a little bitter, it's a little salty, it's too sweet, then you feel like we're not really getting something genuine. You can understand, Krishna says, in fact, in the 10th canto, chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, he says, rasoham, I am the taste of water. But more to the point, he's saying, I am rasa. See, so ruchi, rasa. You get a little flavor of the real thing, and you know it when you see it. You'll know it when you come across it. And so it may be stronger in some gurus than in others, or it may be absent completely in some gurus. So when you find the particular spiritual taste which comes with Radha Krishna, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Bhakti, you can distinguish that. And you will find what is genuine, if you struggle to get more of that same taste. And if you come in contact with someone who gives you that, stick with them and see if they'll take you higher. And they may take you to someone who has even more powerful concentration of ruchi or rasa. And then you'll know, this is really guru tattva. And on the other hand, if you find that what was at once strong is becoming a weaker and weaker signal, then you have to search out, where is the true light, where is the true signal? Just like this broadcast that we're doing is a radio signal. Some people will find, oh, the signal's breaking up. I'm not in a good spot. I need to move my laptop to a closer Wi-Fi connection, right? So find where the Wi-Fi connection is the strongest. You will understand, oh, I'm connected. Wow, woo, this is a fast connection. And you will understand, there's something here, but it's not so strong, but I'm getting something. Like that. Guru Tattva will make itself known to you if you really search for it. I hope that helps you. Thank you, Kamala.
Definitely.
Yes. Any other questions from anyone out there? We're very happy to hear from you.
Yes. The next, actually, feedback, more feedback than a question came. The first part of it. I think that's limitations of the live stream. But Anushya is writing, Dandavats Maharaj, you may remember me from 62S 13th Street.
South 13th Street, yeah.
When I was called Ananga.
Ananga?
It is wonderful to see you and hear you after all these years.
Ananga,
I don't have a
Manjari,
question now,
yeah.
But I want to let the end of the question.
She what?
That's it. She's sending her Dandavats.
Dandavas to you, Ananga Manjari. Thank you for saying hello. I'm astounded. This connection with the devotees is bringing warmth to my heart and giving me oxygen, and I can breathe. If the heart doesn't have oxygen, the heart dies. And so the association of devotees, it's like oxygen. So getting back to the other question about Guru Tattva, if there's no oxygen in the room, you know. And you know when you can breathe. So find out the oxygen. Yeah.
The end of the message came. I wanted to let you know how much you are bringing, how much joy you are bringing to my heart.
Oh. As we say in Mexico, igualmente.
And going back to the first book published, Search for Sri Krishna, one of the memorizable quotes from it is about that when you go on the Krishna consciousness, the road of Krishna consciousness, the search for Sri Krishna, you feel that your inner hankering, it's being diminished, like it's being satisfied. It said, in this world, we are getting this and this and this and everything, but still our hunger doesn't diminish. But on the road of the Krishna consciousness, it just gets you get the inner satisfaction you were searching for so long.
Yes. Is that a question?
No, so is it? It's just a promotion of the books. So can we get to say something about the last three books? Because there are some books of introductory meaning, but some books of like very deep, like subjective evolution of consciousness.
Okay, well, you know, we did the Search for Sri Krishna kind of, we're thinking, this will be an introduction. Of course, many people read that and say, this is too high. This is for the intelligentsia. We can't understand it. It's not an introduction. So then we thought, well, what's really introductory? The guru. Try to understand that. But we come from the Gaudiya Vaishnava line, and our real sympathy, our real loyalty is with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So the next book we discovered was The Golden Volcano of Divine Love. In a way, these books are also discoveries because Sridhar Maharaj is there in Navadvip Dham on the banks of the Ganges, and this is what he's giving. So if we listen, we find that he gives Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So the golden volcano of divine love, the title has to do with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's inner feeling. Now, who is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? That's really the subject of our book. The idea is, we were discussing this morning, Sridhar Maharaj used to like the expression die to live. It's Hegelian, thesis, synthesis, antithesis. So I asked Gopa Kishore, what's the greatest thesis?
Supposedly, it's Krishna.
No, it's not supposedly. We believe that it is, you know. We have it from our guru that this is reality, and I feel this is real. So we can say, yes, the highest thesis is Krishna, God, Krishna. How is God? Is God an old man in the clouds who's too old to have a good time? He's just suffering. He's tired. He has a heart problem. He's got high cholesterol, and he can't remember when he created the world very well because it was so long ago. Adam and Eve, now they're having a good time. So the earth was created for their pleasure, no? According to what we know, if you think about it, reality is by itself and for itself, so God must be having a good time. In fact, everything is for his pleasure. In Sanskrit, we call this Purush. Purush means Lord, but it also means the subject. He's not the object. Prakriti means object. So the Lord, he's enjoying himself, his Prakriti. The relationship between Purush and Prakriti, that's thesis and antithesis. Right? So if Krishna is the thesis, what's the antithesis?
Srimati Radharani.
So you have Radha Krishna. You have the supreme positive and the supreme negative involved in some constant relationship which is give and take on the highest level of divine love. When we say negative, we don't mean this in a pejorative sense. We mean this is the complement to the positive. What we find in the positive is power. What we find in the negative is love. So the combination of power and love, or the relationship between the lover and the beloved. So now Hegel, he also talks about the master-slave relationship. And this is interesting because what he says is, if one is the master and another is the slave, what happens is sooner or later, by service, the master is conquered and the slave becomes the master. By serving the master, the slave has control over the master and the master becomes helpless. So Radharani's love is like that. It's so powerful, it overpowers God himself. And this is a strange thing to say because we're not supposed to promote slavery. But this is also in the Golden Volcano of Divine Love talks about divine slavery. But this is a Hegelian concept that when the thesis meets the antithesis, the relationship is so powerful that it creates a synthesis. So what would be the synthesis?
Mahaprabhu.
Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Yes. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is metta. Metta means if you go outside yourself and try to reflect on how you're thinking, metacognition. So if Krishna, using his divine intelligence or will, looks outside the Radha Krishna relationship and tries to analyze it, what he will find is the Radha part is even better than the Krishna part. Why? Because through service, Radha is experiencing more ananda than Krishna. The one who serves has a greater taste, rasa, than the one who's being served. You know, try it sometime. Be a sannyasi and accept service. And you'll find that after a while, it's dry, it's tiring, it's punishing. Whereas serving somebody, it's sweet, it's happy. So Krishna thinks, I want to find out about this. What would that be like? How could I try this out for myself? So he comes in the form of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to discover what is service. And what he discovers is, this is a higher position. So Milton said, better to serve in heaven than to reign in hell. We prefer a service position. But the devotees are even more extreme. We say, I can serve in hell. It doesn't matter. Put me where you want. If I get a chance to serve Krishna, I'll be happy. So even if we have to go to hell to preach Krishna consciousness, we're ready for that.
Goswami Maharaj sometimes refer to the neophyte devotees as nectar seekers, but on the samadhi of Srila Sridhar Maharaj, it's samadhi of love in separation.
Okay, and this is a really good point, because many people, they come to Krishna consciousness thinking, wow, this is cool, get high naturally, you don't need psychedelic drugs, this is the new crack cocaine, you can just take this and whew, you can go to the top. And what happens is, it's true, you get this ruchi or rasa, if you like, that we were talking about before, which attracts you. But real realization on the path of Krishna consciousness, it has to do with service. And you're not serving because if you serve, you get ananda. It's not a give and take. It's not, I'm going to do this and then I'll get that. You serve because you have to. Like real musicians, they're musicians because they have to be musicians. They don't know anything else. They can't make any money. They're not successful. It doesn't matter. That's what they do. They're musicians. It's their dharma. So if you have the taste for Krishna consciousness, you have to serve Krishna. So ultimately, you're not interested in bhukti, mukti, or anything. All you want is to serve. You're not even interested in divine love. If you're thinking, well, let me see, if I do the sadhana bhakti and I practice the ritual and I cook the prasadam and I serve the devotees, then later I'll get something. I know I'll get something. I'll leave this planet and I'll go to a higher world. And I hate this planet because it stinks and everything here is terrible and bad. That's not a good attitude, see? You have to develop a service attitude where you don't care how terrible everything is. All you want to do is serve. And that's a very difficult place to get to. But that's what the higher devotees are busy doing while we're trying to puzzle through our daily life.
Yes.
And I'm very, as we say in Spanish, we have this word apenada or apenado. It means embarrassed. So I'm sitting here pontificating in a room with 10 people. And I'd like to take the opportunity to thank the devotees here who are giving back to me what I tried to give years ago and perhaps lost to some extent. So I want to personally thank my interlocutor, who's off camera, Gopakishore, for creating this dialogue. Real truth often comes out through dialogue, because if I'm only talking and thinking that I have the truth, it's very stale. But if you can give me something back, there's more dynamic. And I'd like to thank Bhakti Lalita for her presence and for reminding us all of Govinda Maharaj, Amiya Krishna for travel arrangements, Aurora for the trip from Mexico, and Yuvati. Who took us to market and knows Chiang Mai in and out, and our director, Induleka, Ramakanta, who's behind the controls at the production. I can't see everybody.
Leelavati,
there she is. Leelavati, who's always expert in serving everybody. I don't know how she does it, but she's always there doing something. And Annalena Sundari. And
Pavan Krishna,
who are making the whole experience in Chiang Mai really worthwhile. So if you're watching this production and liking anything, please send your comments, tell your friends, watch the
upcoming channel. Series of our events.
What is it?
The upcoming series of our events will have only two more broadcasts, Monday, Wednesday.
Next Monday, next Wednesday, we'll do this again, and then I will disappear. So goodbye, Chiang Mai, and goodbye, Hare Krishna.
No.
Anyways, we're very happy to come here and work with all of you, and we will work with you in the future, I'm sure.
There is one part in the at the beginning of Search for Shri Krishna where Krishna is shamelessly expressing himself and glorifying his devotees and Krishna consciousness. So I think in the following series we can talk about loving search for the last servant, which I think fits very good to your story, and we'll keep our viewers with this.
So stay tuned, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, and Vaishnavas of all ages.